February 6th, about 9:35. Senator Pierce, Co-Chairman Pierce, was unavoidably delayed for a few moments, short time this morning. She will be here and will take over chairing the meeting when she does. But she wanted us to proceed.
Wow.
We'll, members present, is Senator Donnelly, Senator Torgerson, Senator Parnell, Senator Phillips, and myself, Senator Sharp. We have scheduled, first, is Alaska overview of the Alaska Railroad Corporation today. We have the Alaska Railroad general manager, president, and all officials here, it looks like. I would ask Governor Sheffield if he'd come forward and bring anyone he'd want to the table and proceed as he desires.
Well, Senator Sharp, thank you very much for the opportunity to come before the Senate Finance Committee and give an overview of the Alaska Railroad Corporation. I'm the president and CEO. Name is Bill Sheffield. With me is Jim Blasingame, Vice President of Corporate Affairs. Jim's been with the Alaska Railroad about 30 years, and I think only one person had been there longer than him, and he was instrumental in the transfer of ownership from the federal government back in 84-85. Also with me is Jerry Anderson, the railroad's new chief financial officer, who brings to us a strong background of public administration and public finance. And Tom Brooks is our chief engineer, acting vice president in charge of mechanical and engineering at the present time, and knows every bridge and mile of track from mile zero and Seward all the way up to Fairbanks and Isles and Air Force Base, and is on the trail a lot. Also in the room is who you all know, of course, is Joe Perkins, Commissioner of DOT. Joe sits on our board as the Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. I'd just like to give you some main points, a little overview of the Alaska Railroad, if I can. It's our 75th anniversary year. President Harding drove the Golden Spike in Nenana in July of 1923, and we're going to celebrate that driving of the Golden Spike again for his 75th anniversary in Nenana. It's planned for July 15th. It's one of the oldest and most vibrant public institutions in Alaska, providing freight and passenger service for 75 years, and our employees take a lot of pride in that tradition, and they do an excellent job. I don't know if you've ever been around railroaders much, but they're a tough bunch of hombres, and their daddy worked for the railroad and they're a dedicated bunch of people, and we have about 525 of them with the Alaska Railroad on a regular basis. Our payroll goes up to around 700 in the summertime with increased passenger service and increased freight business. They did an excellent job in 1997 that we set another record for net earnings last year. The railroad earned $10.6 million in 1997, an increase of 32% over 96. Why did it happen? We had good weather. We had a lot of construction in Anchorage. We hauled a lot of gravel. We need more Home Depots and hotels building, I guess. We hauled it in all that peat bog up there. We hauled a lot of gravel. That helped. Improved efficiencies in rail operations, consistent real estate returns, and we had a record passenger service season as well, well over 600,000 people, up from 550 the year before. It also means that the railroad plows its earnings back into the line. It means that we're self-sustaining and do not come to the legislature for money. It also means that we can set the stage for future growth. The high earnings allowed us to pay down our long-term debt, which is now at an all-time low. By the end of next year, there will be no more long-term debt. that exists now, or at the end of this year. It positions us to buy new locomotives, expand service and or rail, and step up our capital program. So again, I want to emphasize that the money we earn goes back into the line to make it safer, to provide better service to our customers, to increase the value of the asset to the state. 1998 is a historic year and a pivotal one for the business. We're preparing to introduce new equipment that will improve all aspects of the operation. I'm referring directly to new 4,000 horsepower AC locomotives. We've already purchased a lot of new coal cars for our route for hauling the Healy coal north and south. We're launching an aggressive safety and maintenance upgrades, financed in part with federal grants based on our status as a passenger carrier. Most other states have Amtrak. We do not have. We're filling that need. Therefore, we do get some grants from the federal government. And also, we've replaced 200,000 ties over the last 2 years and have budgeted for another 100,000 ties on the north end of the railroad this year. Next year, we'll start working our way south for a couple of years. Then we'll be caught up and we'll be putting in about 35,000 to 40,000 ties a year. The state of Alaska and the railroad are grateful to our congressional delegation, especially Senator Stevens, who are behind the railroad 100%. And many thanks to this legislature for your continued interest and involvement in this successful public corporation. We look forward to working cooperatively with you on any matters the legislature and these committees may have an interest in. We're a good example of a public corporation that is able to take advantage of private sector business efficiencies. I hope you will continue to support this state institution as it is. Maintain our ability to service our customers and be flexible. A good example is, and there's so many examples, but let me give one that just happened just last week that we've been working on for probably 5 or 6 months, maybe longer than that in some example, in some instances. We have a three-year agreement with ARCO to haul their pipe from the lower 48 across our rail barge on into Fairbanks, as we do have with BP. In the case of ARCO, we're going to, in addition to moving the pipe, the railroad will unload it in Fairbanks and load it on trucks to be trucked then on up to Prudhoe Bay. Our financial flexibility to purchase a forklift and a large magnet to grab a hold of that pipe, unload it, put it on the ground, and load it again on trucks, and hire the people to make it happen, made that possible, the flexibility we have to run our business. We've made an agreement with ARCO that all of this pipe will be shipped in gondolas to Fairbanks. Therefore, the scrap dealers in Fairbanks will be able to ship all the scrap back out on those gondolas going back out to lower 48, so we're getting a double haul out of it, and it serves a real purpose for the interior of Alaska. And so, like I say, we've been working on that for well over a year, but intensely the last 5 or 6 months. But at budget time, when we prepared our own budget last November and October for this fiscal year, we didn't have that deal. And so we just signed it last week. So maintain our ability to remain self-sustaining is important to us, important to the people of Alaska. Maintain the railroad as a vital public transportation network, and as I said earlier, we had more than 600,000 passengers last year. Our main objective for this year is safety. A new plan will identify root causes of personal injuries on our railroad, communicate causes to employees, establish responsibilities for proactive preventive actions, and provide employee training, reward employees for working safely. Our safety is okay, but we want it to be the best in the industry. So we're going on a major program this year to help improve that. We plan to meet our bottom line target by doing the following: handling increases in MAPCO production that starts the last quarter of this year. We'll start two trains a day instead of one train. Our interline freight is climbing all the time. Our barge service from Prince Rupert and in Washington State and into Whittier. Our traders on flat car, we call it the Topsy business, is good. We promised delivery in Fairbanks by 9 o'clock the next morning. We haven't missed yet in over a year. Delivery of coal in 1998 and beyond is a real target. This is the last year of our coal contract for shipping coal to Seoul, Korea, to Kepco Power Plant. We are in the process now of settling the 98 prices and extension of the contract. And I think Wishbone Hill development and opening in a couple of years will play a big part in us being able to keep that contract and shipping a better grade of coal and a very low sulfur coal as well. And so Wishbone Hill will probably open up other markets in the lower 48 and Russia possibly. We had a 20,000 ton shipment to Magadan about a month ago, and there's a possibility we might be shipping them 200,000-300,000 tons a year. They have a lot of coal in Russia, but they don't have any transportation network to get it anywhere. So that's a strong possibility. So we'll be probably hauling Yusubeli coal from Wishbone, both north and south, in about 2 years. We're, of course, improving our real estate leasing program and putting more people in Alaska Railroad passenger seats all the time. Another key objective is to manage the new locomotive program as something that touches all aspects of the operation. And we buy 16 new locomotives and get the final delivery of the 16. We will reduce our fleet from about 47 locomotives down to 31. It means we have more power and more capability in the locomotives that we'll own. The 4,000 horsepower engines have more, they use less fuel, they carry more fuel, they have more adhesion to the track than our DC locomotives. We won't stall out on a hill. And if we use 6 locomotives for a MAPCO train now or a coal train, we'll use 3. A MAPCO train that uses 5, we'll use 2. Gravel trains, we'll use 2. Where now we use 3 on a push-up at Spinard Hill. So you can see the savings that we'll have in the maintenance and the operation cost of those locomotives. So the locomotives will be is involved in safety and maintenance costs, environmental quality improvements, ability to pull more with fewer locomotives. And we've done one other important thing. We formed an employee committee to ensure that everyone in the railroad is in the loop on and how we change, how we do business, and how we operate in the shops with these new locomotives. So we're constantly having feedback from all of the employees of the railroad. Put in a lot of effort into improving communications internally and with the legislature and the Alaska public. This is the second year we've come to Juneau to brief you folks, and we hope we get a chance to continue to do that. We had great success with the Ship Creek Advisory Committee formed by Mayor Maestrom. We worked with them and came up with a plan that I think everybody's fairly happy with. I don't know if you've had a chance to see that in the plan in the daily newspaper. I have a few copies of the plan here. Be glad to distribute them to you. We think it was successful, and it's a plan that people like. There'll be some deviations from it, of course, but I think it's a road that we're starting on now to develop that area that might work. We've begun to form advisory committees in Seward and Fairbanks to help us with the land use plan issues in those communities. In the same light, our community advisory board, consisting of mayors and chamber of commerce presidents and executive directors, will meet later this February for a briefing similar to this one, and for us to field any questions or concerns that they might have. We are working hard with the city of Whittier to develop plans that will help them meet the demands of the folks that use the new road in the year 2000. As you know, we have a lot of land in Whittier. We're working with the city of Whittier on the utilities, giving them all the easements for the water, for the sewer, the road, the power, and DOT and ourselves are working with the city on a master plan that will help them guide themselves for the best land use planning that would develop the most income for them in the future. Short-term expansion for the railroad is Anchorage Airport. There's reasons for that. I'll tell you in a minute. Railroad into the airport on the north side of the parking garage. The Girdwood Spur, we're talking to the Girdwood community, working with them to see if they want to have commuter service, if they want a railroad spur up into the Alyeska area. Manuska Valley to Anchorage commuter line is one of our goals. It all kind of ties in with Seward and Whittier and Fairbanks and the airport. We have a lot of curves from the Manuska Valley to Anchorage, and we have some 40-mile-an-hour line in that area, but most of it's 25. And to get to the military bases, it is 25. We are launching a program starting this year to improve that line up to a 45-mile-an-hour railroad from Matanuska Valley to Anchorage, and we'll be working with the military on their areas, maybe get our tracks off the end of their runway, and which will help straighten out the curves, and they'll speed up the railroad for freight, passengers, and gravel and everything. The airport's important to us to tie our south end business in, to get more passenger service, to get them to the airport faster. Half the people off a cruise ship are going home, and they only want to get to the airport. The other half are coming to town to do other things and go on to Fairbanks and around the whole pattern. So the airport's a key thing to us. We'll be letting probably an RFP going out this summer to do the feasibility of that and the engineering. The preliminary engineering. Long-term expansion is to the Arctic. So one of Senator Murkowski's plans that we're supporting and lending some of our engineering staff to. Kantishna, north of Mount McKinley. And of course, we always need a business justification for going someplace. The Alaska Railroad plays an important part in Alaska's economy. Coal, petroleum, chemicals, hazardous materials, and waste at the railroad hall for the mining industry, the oil industry, gravel, timber, passengers, heavy equipment, big stuff on our rail barges, on our freight cars, steel balls for Fort Knox. A load of them goes up there every week. That's how they beat up the rock with it, sift out the gold, I guess, how that works. We even provide the flour that fresh bread is baked in Anchorage every day. So we kind of touch a lot of people's needs. We only haul probably 10-12% of the freight in Alaska, but it's an important 10-12%. We have some needs. We're always looking at equipment, more equipment, new equipment. Tom Brooks may have a chance to tell you about, we bought a railroad that was built in 1923 and rehabbed in, to some extent in 1950, and we have some big curves around some of the canyons up north, and some 16-degree curves. We're going to take some of those curves out this year and straighten them down to 12, and then we'll get them down to 9 degrees the next time around, and all that does is make it safer and helps to speed up the railroad. The final points I'd like to mention is we're self-sustaining because we can operate free of government inefficiencies, and we can be responsive to our customers. That's nothing wrong with the government. It's just that we're able to move faster and be more responsive on a daily basis to our customers. We're a different operation. We have to keep on the move all the time and be up to speed and get the business and provide the best service we can. We provide good service to our customers because we're business-based. And if you could just ask our customers, MAPCO or BP or ARCO or Fort Knox or Anchorage Sand and Gravel or scrap dealers or passengers, ask anybody, Usabelli, they'll tell you that they like how we do business. We can do things like Whittier Road and the flag stop service because we have a public mission, improving hurricane turn and service to Seward and Whittier. And our next year we'll have baggage cars on our trips to Seward so that they can carry bicycles and canoes and all of those things that people like to do when they go down to Seward. Real estate is critical to making money and staying self-sustaining, although the transportation services this year, Jerry Anderson will tell you, exceeded our railroad's net income for the first time in history. We're capital intensive, and profits are really just next year's maintenance money and operating capital in the railroad business. Anyway, we appreciate your interest, and we'll work hard to provide you with whatever information you need. And if you're not getting it, and you've got a question, all you got to do is call me. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you. Questions by committee members on what's been presented so far? I would just say, by looking at the chart, and you touched on it in your narrative, that you must be tremendous leverage on increased volume to increase the net that much from one year to the next on your bar chart.
Well, it's partly yes.
I know you're high fixed cost operation. Once you get above that fixed cost line,
it's like the business I used to be in, the hotel business. You can when you go from 85% to 100% occupancy, all your fixed costs are still there. All you got's another hour or two for a maid, and that's about it. In our business, it's the same thing. We'll be pulling 50% more for MAPCO. We're in the business. Our trains are running. We have to fuel them, of course, and we have to staff them. But the routes are there, and the efficiencies are there when you get over a certain hump. Our coal trains, the efficiencies, and some of the efficiencies and some of the profits are cranked in there because of our new locomotives.
Are they going to be delivered this year?
We'll get them in the third quarter of next year, Senator, the first eight. But we're in a quandary right now whether we're going to increase that eight to maybe 12 and take the last four of the next year. We have time to move on that yet. We haven't decided. We may take more than the first eight, and then 2 years later, we may get them faster than that. The efficiencies in those locomotives add even more than we've showed on the bottom line there. As we start to build new shops and get rid of the old shops, it costs us $3 or $4 or $5 million a year overhead to maintain, and we build new shops, smaller shops, more efficient shops, the bottom line goes up. We don't lose any employees because the railroad's going to grow, but we're going to be more efficient, so we'll have more profit. And I think probably, while those look like astronomical numbers, when we used to be in a losing situation, I think the numbers will probably be a little higher than that.
Other questions at the general overview? Senator Torgerson?
Thank you. Okay. Governor, I was looking on this last page of the handout, and
okay.
Capital project funding. And I haven't seen these categories before, so I thought maybe you might explain them. But you got FRA funding, which Federal Rail Administration, I guess.
Yes.
Locomotive borrowing, which you talked about that, but locomotive savings fund and the additional internal funds. Can you explain those?
Sure, Jerry. Do you want to do that yourself?
Senator Torgerson, the locomotive savings fund is. What we're doing now is setting aside $2.5 million a year so that when the locomotives are delivered in 1999, we can make a cash payment towards the purchase price. So we'll only finance maybe half of the actual purchase price. The additional internal funds, that's our bottom line, net income plus depreciation.
That will be spending on the capital budget.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. And just one other question then. On page 10, we talk about opening three new depots. Did you mention those three that you opened? Or did you actually open three or just...
No, we actually built a new one in Seward and a new one in Talkeetna and a new one in Girdwood. And then next year... We'll be improving the one and kind of remodeling and improving to a large degree the one at Denali, And, where's the other two?
We've got ongoing work in, Anchorage Depot also.
Oh, in the Anchorage Depot. We, going back into, in Fairbanks, we've got to have ADA-approved restrooms, and so we're doing some major renovations to make that happen all over. The ones we built new this time, of course, are ADA-approved.
Thank you.
Other questions, Senator Phillips?
So, could you give us a status on this, both by the city of Whittier or buying land?
Pardon?
The city of Whittier buying land, leasing land, or whatever their, what the proposal is, what's the railroad doing on that, the status of that?
We,
Hundred acres?
Well, I don't remember the number of acres, Whittier has or we have, but basically, we have or in the process of doing this, we just sent an agreement to them. It's been going back and forth, to get it tidied up properly, but it went back again this morning to Whittier. We've given them easements to all of the utilities in Whittier. And, while we don't have as-builts of all the utilities, neither do they, and we've merely required them to give us as-builts as they replace utilities or build something new, and so that we have a copy of it as well. The Corps of Engineers has some. We have some. We're busy gathering them up and giving them to them. We have leased them at a municipality rate, not a market rate, the railroad land around the boat harbor, so that they can develop that land and lease it to people that they, for their highest and best use for the boat harbor. How they're going to make their money is off the improvements on those lands, so they get tax dollars. We're leasing them land up on the hill for their RV parks and things of that nature, at a what we would call a good rate for them, so they can make money on it. We have agreed to build a Viking harbor, which is next to the existing boat harbor, and we're working on the economics of that now, if it works. There's other people, and the small boat owners in Prince William Sound want to build their own harbor now, and that's fine with us. Then we wouldn't build a small harbor to house those five or six boats, but we don't know that yet, so we're waiting for them to get back to us. We're doing everything we can within the limits of our structure and of our mandate to cooperate with Whittier. Along with another state agency, putting in $50,000 that we have granted this for a long time, but we haven't spent the money. But between the DOT and the railroad and the city of Whittier, we're gonna put in $100,000 to the city of Whittier for them to do a master plan and hire consultants to help map out what's going to happen when these million people come there and the doors open up in the tunnel and here comes everybody and they need restrooms and places to park. And they have no money, so we're doing that. We're in the process of that now. So I think that while sometimes on the surface it looks like our relations are not all that good, I'm doing everything I can, Senator. I've taken it over myself to... And I got a lot of good help here to make that happen right, so that those people are happy, and that the customer coming in and when the road gets built have a place to go to the bathroom.
Other than the Prince William Sound.
True. Right.
Other questions? I have specifically a question. Anything else? Governor, thank you for coming this morning. I have a couple of specific questions, and I'll start with follow up on Whittier questions, I guess. Can you tell us, whichever one of you is appropriate, the extent of the railroad's land holdings in Whittier, or in the Whittier area? I'm not sure where the city limits are, but what does the railroad own and what doesn't the railroad own in Whittier?
Well, Senator, basically, I don't have a map to be able to, I wish we had our charts here, but we should have maybe brought them, but we have about 42% of the land in Whittier. That's about right. 42-43% of the land in Whittier is railroad land. How much of that our tracks are on? Maybe half. Maybe it's only 40% of that land is where our tracks run on for over to our freight depot. And then we have the marginal wharf, what we might call the cruise ship docks. And really, our only business in there is hauling passengers and freight, and that's been the purpose of the railroad in there, and it will always be the purpose. We have land around the boat harbor area. We have land upland of that, and then there's land out by the tunnel where you come through the tunnel that belongs to the railroad on both sides of the track. There's a lot of federal land in there. There's some state land. There's a lot of military Corps of Engineer federal land in there that probably equals more than we have. More at the head of the bay as you come out of the tunnel to the left. But we do have, and we made a presentation at Fairbanks to a panel, a Senate hearing, I think a couple years ago. We had all the charts and everything out, but if you'd like to see that, I'd be happy. We'd be happy to come back and show it to you. And not only have to have a public hearing, but just show it to you in your office.
Actually, I assume this was put together by the city of Whittier, but my staff managed to come up with one of the maps, so I'm sure you're familiar with that. Because of Representative Martin's ongoing questions about railroad land that's essential to your primary mission of hauling passengers and freight up and down the rail belt, and your secondary missions with your other real estate, do you identify your land base in those two categories at all? What you said, maybe 40% of your land in Whittier is actually essential to your primary mission. Is that the way that you actually categorize your land?
Well, we really don't anywhere. It's just that, you know, we have 38,000 acres in total, and so we have a certain amount of land in every town: Fairbanks, Talkeetna, Anchorage, and it's all developable in those towns for us, and we just categorize it as leased land. We do know how much though that our tracks are on, and in every case, I just don't have it in my head, but we do know that.
Does the railroad maintain the roads in Whittier?
We maintain all of our own roadbed.
Are you talking about the public roads,
public
the highways? The in Whittier, the military was maintaining most of the roads because they had a tank farm at one end of town and their barge dock at the other end of town, and they maintained all of the roads through town. We maintained the local roads that serve the railroad. Since the military left last fall, they donated some pieces of equipment to the city of Whittier to maintain that road, and they've had some problems with that equipment, and we've been working cooperatively with them to get the snow removal done in the places everybody needs to go. They've been doing most of the more municipal uses. We've been taking care of the railroad, of course, and the road to the tank farm has been sort of a joint project this winter.
What is the legal, the legal way that a civilian who doesn't work for the Alaska Railroad or isn't paying customer on the Alaska Railroad, is there a permit that the city of Whittier holds or that somebody holds to allow them access to your railroad property to drive around Whittier? Is there some sort of an overall permit that allows people to get to the Alaskans to get to the boat harbor? You have to cross railroad land to get there.
The city or the military in the past or DOT in the present hold the permits from the railroad for right-of-ways and easements that grant access to the public. So, for example, the road that's between the boat harbor and the railroad tracks, there is a permit to the city of Whittier for them to use that land.
And it's a DOT permit?
No, that's a city of Whittier permit, in that case.
That they got from DOT, that's what you said?
No, that they got from us. DOT picks up at the western end of town and goes out to the tank farm. That was the old military permit that DOT has assumed.
The state assumed the military permit?
Essentially, yeah.
So is the state now responsible for road maintenance?
They have the permit for that road. Of course, they don't have a highway that's connected to the rest of the system, so they have no way to maintain it.
But they're responsible
for the road was built for access to the military's tank farm.
Right.
We granted a permit to the military years ago, and they've been maintaining the road. In the process of the DOT project to build the road to Whittier, they came to us and basically assumed the responsibility for that road, but they haven't really become active because they've got no way to get equipment in there to do any maintenance.
But the expectation is that the State Department of Transportation will have the responsibility for that road after the access road is finished.
I understand that they're going to improve that road once they get through the tunnel, then they're going to improve that road that goes through Whittier.
Any further Whittier questions? Anybody? Sure. And Governor, you may have answered this, and I apologize for being late. I was down at Comtech. Because of your ability, and we are so appreciative of our delegation day after day after day, but because of the availability of federal funding for the railroad that has certainly provided you with an opportunity to do a lot of maintenance and upgrades that you wouldn't otherwise, I think, have been able to do, what are the impacts financially look like on the railroad of those capital improvement projects, in that would you have shown a profit had it not been for the federal funds that came in this past year, for example?
Yes, Senator, we've showed a profit for the last 3 years, 7.9, 8.1, and 10.6. It has nothing to do with the federal funds that we received. Those federal funds go in and go out on capital projects, specific capital projects. In this case, the $10 million federal grant that Senator Stevens got us for the last 2 years, and again this year, that $10 million that went into TIE program, the acquisition of ties and the labor and the equipment to install those ties, plus some bridge work. The first grant was six went into that program, and $4 million went into a communications program to improve the microwave relay system that the state and the railroad uses from Anchorage to Fairbanks, as well as digital computerized dispatching system for the railroad. That money goes in and goes out. I guess I've answered that question about 100 times. I don't know if I ever answer it right, or so somebody understands it. Maybe you have to be an accountant, but Jerry can do it. But it doesn't show in any way our as revenue for our P&L for that year.
Well, I'm not saying that that's revenue. I fully understand that. However, you are displacing monies that the railroad would have had to have spent out of your own revenue stream with federal funds for capital projects. So I guess the real question is, of the $10 million you were able to spend on ties and ballast this year, most of that money had come from Senator Stevens. How much of that was essential to the integrity of the railroad that you would have had to have spent from railroad funds had you not had the federal grant? I guess that's the proper way to ask.
Well,
we
just capitalized that. We just still had the same profit in our operations of the railroad, but we would have capitalized that money. We would have spent that money on ties and ballast, but we would have been capitalized. But we would have still had the same profit earnings in our railroad operation. We would have spent all of that money that we made in those projects, where we didn't have to spend all that money in those projects. We paid down a lot of long-term debt, and we were able to save up some money for new locomotives and things like that. So, in a sense, that you know, it, of course it helps. There's no doubt about it. It's money we don't have to spend ourselves, although if we're spending $10 million of federal grant money, we're also spending $14 to $17 million of our own money on capital improvement projects every year. That's the profit we make plus the depreciation on those dollars. So if we make 10, we've got another 5 or 6 in depreciation with the cash dollars that we can spend. Do you have anything to add?
I can add something there. As the governor mentioned earlier, the railroad was rebuilt in the 50s, and we have an aging population of railroad ties out there. And so we've directed most of the federal money we've received towards that program. And we've got about 1.9 million railroad ties on the Alaska Railroad, and we replaced about 100,000 in each of the last 2 years. So we put about a 10% dent in the renewal. About 60% of our cross ties right now are 30 years old or older. So there's quite a aging population out there that we need to impact. As we use the federal grant money to take and change out railroad ties, we're really not doing a whole lot to improve the overall efficiency of the operation. And we are able to take the earnings that we generate internally and redirect them to other efforts, such as building depots and places like Whittier and Seward, which we wouldn't have otherwise done, or may not have otherwise done. But the direct impact to the bottom line of that federal grant money really isn't, certainly no direct impact. There may be some secondary impact over the years.
Senator, one of the things that Governor Sheffield had mentioned and Tom Brooks had mentioned is that during the war years, the military took control of the Alaska Railroad and operated it strictly, but they didn't maintain it. So after the war, the Congress came in and basically infused about $60 million into rehabilitation of the rail line. And what Tom is saying is the chief engineer came in and put all new ties and rail in all at once. He's at a point now of having to go back of replacing all that because it's all wearing out at one time. And normally any other railroad would put in, you know, an X number of million of dollars on an annualized maintenance basis. The railroad under federal ownership didn't generate the necessary net revenues that it needed to keep putting that back on an annualized basis. So we're playing catch-up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand that we're playing catch-up. I'm just concerned, will we be able to continue catching up with our own resources if something happens to the federal funds?
Sure.
And as we've learned in some of our other programs, those federal funds are not always forthcoming, even when there's a surplus at the federal level. At the Municipal League Conference, this fall, a number of communities in the state, and include my community of Anchorage, almost Seward, Whittier, Palmer, Matthew Borough, and Nenana, and perhaps others, formed an ad hoc committee of Rail Belt communities to review local needs and kind of the their relations with the railroad, and I'm sure you're familiar with the group. Does the railroad have a formal dispute resolution process of some sort to deal with communities when there's a dispute between the railroad and a local community on a land use issue or whatever other? Is there some formal process that the communities know they can enter with the railroad? Because we certainly have those sorts of things in statute for other sorts of disputes.
Well, I think the best way for me to answer that is that probably we don't have a formal method, although I general counsel might correct me, maybe we do have, but we have a briefing council that's supposed to meet quarterly, and we're a little remiss this time because it's been almost 5 months, but we're meeting again next week. We invite the mayors and those administrative people from all the rail-built communities, including the Kenai Borough, because we call them our neighbor down there, and of course, they're over the city of Seward. And we invite the executive directors and the presidents of the Chamber of Commerce's and we've always met in Anchorage so far. It seems to be where everybody wants to meet. And we meet again on the February the 18th. We tell them what we're doing, what our plans are in the future, and maybe how it affects their community, and then we get their feedback back, and that's how we've been operating. In addition to that, since it was so successful in the city of Anchorage recently on the Ship Creek development project, they had a quadrant of people that worked on that development plan. That I've talked to the mayor of Seward and the borough mayor of Fairbanks to create the same thing for our properties in those communities, so we get more input as to what they think ought to happen to some of this vacant land that we have, and how it would benefit the city of Seward or the borough of Fairbanks. So that seems to be where we're headed. And any conflicts, are brought to our board of directors to listen to and make a decision on, and those people are heard.
Certainly we see in state government at all levels, including the court system, mediation projects coming into place and authorization enabling legislation to allow some formal mediation process so that everybody doesn't always traipse to the courthouse steps and we don't just all make attorneys a lot more wealthy. But I'm wondering, would the railroad be willing to entertain changes to your enabling legislation that would set up a formal mediation process? Because what we find is the communities along the rail belt have finite number of resources, and they don't like having to go through a legal process, and it certainly seems counterproductive to have any community feel that their best method of resolving differences with to go to court. Would you all be willing to consider a formal process that would lead to mediation? These communities are growing. They have a number of certainly space questions, because many of them are hemmed in by mountains and water on a number of sides, or all sides, and I think that we're going to see the number of conflicts actually grow rather than lessen over the years as the communities need space.
Well, it's not that I haven't given a lot of thought to that. I guess sure, we would be receptive, and we would probably even offer up some thoughts and ideas on it for you to think about and act upon. I've been trying since I've been chairman and then resigned that position and CEO and president. I've been trying to make the railroad more kinder, gentler, huh? Where do we hear that once? But anyway, we would be the first to admit here that the railroad has caused some of its own problems in the past, and we're busy trying to get rid of those problems in the past and operate differently. And I think if you just talk to our customers, this is not germane to the conversation we're having, but just ask our customers, and I think they'll tell you that there's a huge change in the Alaska Railroad Corporation in the last 3 or 4 years. We know we have a responsibility. We have 600,000 shareholders, if that's how many people are in Alaska, and we need to make decisions that are right for the railroad. We also need to make sure that it looks good out there and it's right for the people. So we're trying to do that, and we really don't have a problem, a giant problem anywhere except Whittier, and we're trying to close that loop and work through it, and we've taken over here and trying to help those people, and I think you'll find that we will. But I guess we don't have a formal way of handling a dispute. Our board of directors, you know, is kind of the final line for us, and we're using the board a lot more than we used to use the board, put it that way. And the board is pretty benevolent toward the communities and the people. I mean, we can't get along without them. We have to do things that's best for their communities to make it all work right, and we're trying to do that. But we'll be glad to think about that and work something up, Senator, and we'll do that right away.
I would appreciate that, and we'll be happy to work with you. I think there'll be opportunities as legislation moves through the process to be able to formally adopt something. Actually, Governor, you presented perfect segues into a couple of directions of places that I want to take the questioning next. First of all, you were mentioning your board and the importance of the board to the railroad. And I just have a policy question. actually comes up as after review of some university policies and processes as opposed to anything specific to the railroad. But can your board members, firms they're affiliated with or that they own or that their families own, lease land directly from the railroad? And is there any conflict disclosure required? And if so, is that a public, are the conflict of interest disclosures are they public documents, and if so, where are they available?
Yes, they are. They're public documents, and they're updated every annually, January of every year. We have a public disclosure for all board members, a disclosure statement.
Jim. Senator, and what Governor Sheffield has said is that any board member who may be dealing in a business relationship with the corporation has to excuse him or herself from the proceedings from at the time during the board meeting that action is considered. And the record always reflects that.
But board members or their firms or their
correct.
Or firms they're affiliated with can have actual leases with the railroad.
That is correct.
Or business relationships with the railroad.
Yeah, I think we only have that one instance on our board, but that does happen. No.
Okay. We have a series. We have, I think, in the past 2 years, made both our ombudsman staff, but also our legislative audit staff, kind of more interactive is the way to put it, with the finance committees and indeed with the entire legislature, in that while the entire LBNA committee used to look at audits, we've now kind of forced the issue a little further than just that and gotten more public debate on some of the audits. And we just had our annual review at the beginning of each session of audits this past Monday, and your visit is timely in that I'd like to ask some questions that refer to some specific audits that our members, and I think you all have copies of, that have been done in the past couple of years. And let me just say that, Governor, I believe you when you say that you think some of the railroad's problems over the years have been brought on by the railroad itself. And I also think that you have been working hard to fix the whatever public perception of an unfriendly railroad there might be. I am concerned and continue to be concerned, though, by some of the results of the audits and themes that we see that don't seem to change in specific audits that we have done. For example, there was an audit about in Anchorage about gravel activities back in July of 1996, where the auditors, along with questioning whether or not the contract was in the railroad's best interest and whether or not a good public process was followed in getting there, the probably even more troubling points were that the leases were inappropriately offered on a first-come, first-served basis, and the railroad's justification and lack of public process were unclear and problematic. And then we had another audit in August of that same year, 1996, which once again said that leases were not being competitively offered, and the railroad uses just a first-come, first-served approach to leasing property, which certainly doesn't fit with state laws in terms of procurement, and that the corporation didn't have documentation for project development planning, and that your request for proposal criteria and evaluation procedures were inadequate. And then in March of 1997, on equipment acquisition and disposals, we had yet another questioning and a concern by our auditors that you have very weak procedures in terms of leasing, that there was not competitively offered disposal, that there wasn't a formal analysis of the different options being performed. And I would like to know what the railroad has done in response to these audits and requests. What sort of process are you using to try to, you said in your response to these things that, for example, the railroad strives to continuously improve its competitive bid procurement processes, and you would consider the opinions of the auditors and implement them as appropriate. What process are you in to actually adopt those recommendations and change your process so that the public and the legislature can be sure that we do have a competitive process and that we have fair business practices by what I think is undeniably one of the state's most important assets?
Okay, well, let me take them, Senator, from the top down, I guess, the gravel one, the Flamingo Brothers. That was one audit, I think, that you started out with. That was under the old rules and regulations of the railroad, permits didn't have to come before the board of directors. Leases did and still do. We've changed that now for any highly sensitive permit or lease, anything goes before the board of directors, and so it gets more scrutiny and more conversation about it within the board of directors, and so we get more input to management. So I doubt that you'll see a Flamingo Brothers gravel pit come before you in a long time. However, and there's a lawsuit going on about all that right now and a court case, but in the meantime, we think that we got market rate. I guess we'll have a test on that pretty soon as bids get unveiled for gravel in the port area. We'll probably wash our hands of all that maybe in about a year, and I think we'll probably be able to show that we probably did get market rate and we'll get what we said we were going to get. I don't know any other way to answer that. But on competitive leasing, it's been the practice of the railroad to first come, first serve. They want to lease a piece of property, and anywhere we have, we look at it. Does it fit? Does something why we lease it? If somebody comes to us with an idea that they want to have this sort of an idea, and then we go out and we offer that idea to the public in an advertisement, then we're kind of taking the guy's idea and displaying it out there, and so the attitude heretofore has been that would be wrong, because we do get market rate for whatever that we have we go out and we have an appraisal of what that business would do on that piece of property, and we get an appraisal back, and that's what we charge a person. So it's always the highest dollar that we can get as an appraisal. What we're doing, I'd like to say, to kind of make it work better, is that we're doing more planning now. If it's the Chena Landing area in Fairbanks, if it's the Ship Creek area, if it's Seward, if it's Fairbanks or wherever it is, and we have an area of land that we want to develop or we want to lease, we're doing some plan about what the highest and best use of that land is. And then we go out and we try to market that so that we get what's the best for the railroad and best for the community, what everybody wants. We go out and we try to market that so that people come in with ideas that are compatible to that plan. For us to competitively lease in that area, we could do that because we're marketing something that would fit, that we want. In the past, we haven't done very much planning, and so we just kind of, they've been taken first come, first serve, and it looks right, why, at least, and they pay market rate according to an appraisal. So we're trying to match that up and make it work right without infringing on a person's thought, so that he loses the ability to build a business that he wants without having everybody else having the opportunity to know what he's doing.
Any comments on the equipment acquisition and disposal? Oh,
well, I should probably let, I guess that was Evan McKinney, who was Vice President of Mechanical and Engineering at the time. This was, I think you're referring to the heavy equipment, the tie equipment that we had surplus and was old equipment. And this is railroad equipment. This is stuff used on the railroad, on a railroad track.
Yeah.
And there was a company outside that was. I'm going to let Tom Brooks talk about it.
Yeah, we had, when we obtained federal grant money in 1996, we had to gear up for much more production-oriented, much more efficient installation of ties. And as a result, we ended up with a number of surplus machines that were basically 10 years old and weren't suitable for what we were about to do. And there is a limited number of companies that buy this equipment in the lower 48, and we were in touch with a couple of them, and we got a really attractive offer to take all of that equipment off of our hands, and we exercised. We did that. I think it was a good deal for the railroad. I don't think there's any way on a more competitive open process we would have gotten a better deal. We probably would have missed a window. There was the contractor that purchased the equipment wanted it for a particular project, Stampede Pass out of Seattle there, and if we'd have gone through a formal extended process, he would have picked up his equipment somewhere else because he had to get to work.
Just a business decision that we felt it was good for the railroad.
Without touching on personnel issues that I understand may be confidential, having just been down at Comtech this morning talking about the digital age and our leaps into the digital age, the railroad is, I think, the leader amongst, or certainly has been the leader amongst public property owners in terms of right-of-ways for fiber optic systems, and you have certainly piqued the interest, I can say, of both our commissioner of DOTPA, but also our commissioner of DNR, in terms of how much money should we get for right-of-ways in the state. And I think most of the legislators have heard of or know of some of the ongoing discussions on those questions, and I actually was expecting we would come to Juneau and see some legislation. We haven't seen that happen yet. But without talking about any of the personnel issues that may be before you now, can you take us through the process that the Railroad Corporation went through in terms of your decision-making process for the right-of-way for the fiber optic system and tell us how you came up with what you believe to be an appropriate rate for that right away.
Well, I'll tell you to the best of my ability, it was some of that was before my time, and some of it was when I was on the board to begin with, not the president, the CEO. Most of it, I guess, was the we had an appraisal done of our right of way from Fairbanks to Anchorage and from Anchorage to Whittier. We had, and the company that we did it for, UNAT, they wanted one width at one time, then they changed the width. Anyway, they now have a 25-foot right-of-way on our rail line from Anchorage to Whittier. We have a 200-foot right-of-way to begin with. They have 25 foot of it, the exclusive right on 25 feet only. We had an appraisal, and I don't know the name of the company. I know it's about this thick, and I think that we sent a copy to your office.
They will have one.
It's a white book. It's about that thick, and we had it copied for you, and I think I hand carried it to this office. So it's a and I don't remember the name of the company. I'm sorry. And so we established the market rate of our right of way from that appraisal, and I think there was more than one appraisal, so that we could get a gathering of the best knowledge that we could, and that's how we established the rate. The rate for that right of way was established per square foot, and all the square footage was taken into effect. The big bucks are in Anchorage from coming across Elmendorf Air Force Base to get out to Diamond Center, then the property goes downhill, you know, as far as price is concerned. But anyway, for the whole thing, it was close to $2 million. And so we charged $2 million for that permit, $1 million from Anchorage to Fairbanks and $1 million from Anchorage to Whittier. It doesn't add up that way at $1 million and $1 million when you look at the leases, because as they went to Anchorage, then they went to Diamond Center. The main money is in the Anchorage area, so one permit is heavier than the other one, but it all comes out to $2 million the way you look at it. Now we charge just a little less than market value, because what you may not know is that we have an override on their business too, and so if business is good, we go up to $6 million. The minimum rental is $2 million a year. And we get there in 4 years. We jump there. There's two permits, one from Anchorage to Whittier, one from Anchorage to Fairbanks. So I'm going to talk about one permit. We get $250,000 the first year, which we got. We get $500,000 the second year. We get $750,000 the third year. And the fourth year, we get $1 million. And then that's times two, $2 million.
And I understand why the commissioners are so interested.
And we get an override on the business, and we go up to a maximum of $6 million per year, market rate. But we're charged by Constitution to do that, too, you know, so is the state of Alaska.
Here's where I think the legislature and certainly Senator Parnell with his Information Technology Subcommittee gets interested. Where do you interface with the state in terms of the public interest and the public responsibility to be involved in building an infrastructure for communications in our state? Is there, are you working with the TIC on in terms of because the railroad right-of-ways, but they're also They're state-owned public right-of-ways. So how are you coordinating with the rest of state government in terms of what system we're going to build statewide and how all those pieces are going to fit together and what's the, whether there should, and, well, I understand that constitutionally you're supposed to be profit-making, on the other hand, you still are a public entity, and while I would never tell you that you charge too much, where do you coordinate with the state in terms of our responsibility for building some of that infrastructure, too? Because I think most of us would say that we have a certain responsibility to develop this system if we can keep up with it in the state.
Well, we, on several occasions, briefed the administration on telecommunications and what the railroad was doing on the fiber optic cable. You know, it was kind of new then, and now it's just a buzzword around the state, but it was kind of new then, so not too many people knew an awful lot about fiber optic cable, although we had been dealing with AT&T and a lot of companies for a long time before we leased the fiber optic cable to UNAT. It became eventually UNAT/WorldCom. But, you know, we knew that the university needed space. We knew that the military needed space. We knew that everybody needed upgraded telecommunications. We did brief the administration on a couple of occasions that I can think of. Other than that, railroad just went out and got a market rate appraisal for its right of way, and that was the price. I suppose now that there's a lot been said and done about fiber optic cable and all the companies and the race there is to get to Seattle the first with a submarine and away they go, probably it wouldn't be as easy to do all of that. I think we did right. I don't know if it's too much money or not enough, but it was the appraisals that brought it in.
In the appraisals, were the comparables lower 48?
Yes, there was that was done. I should have said that. That was done. I don't have
other
those
rail
in
lines.
Other rail lines were used across the country.
Were they also publicly owned? The same sort of situation that the Alaska Railroad finds itself in? Rather unique.
I don't know that. I really don't know that.
Are the rights of way that you've granted, is it UNET or you? I always forget the name of the company, but anyway, whoever they are these days, are the rights of way exclusive, or is there space available for other?
There is space available, but that 25-foot width of right of way is exclusive for that customer. But there's another 75 feet. Times, well, it's 175 feet more that's available too for anyone else, and we have ATU, AT&T, DCI has been given a lease on I think 8 or 9 miles of right of way in the Whittier area, so there are other ATU has been on our ground for a long time,
and have the, let's say, an AT&T. An ATU right of way in Anchorage. Are you basing the fee that they're being charged on the same appraisal, or the same?
No, that was
charging
a long,
the same amount.
No, that was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when it
so
I
when that comes up,
comes
yeah,
up, is
when
it
that comes
your
up
for reappraisal.
When that comes up, they're going to complain.
We can't wait.
Right.
I can guess who's going to hear the complaint.
Right.
Okay. Other questions? Any other comments?
Maybe Tom could just explain the microwave relay system that we...
Back in the days when the railroad was owned by the federal government, the federal got together with the state and established a microwave system that runs from Seward to Fairbanks. The state has other parts, other portions that aren't the railroad isn't in with, but... In the process of working with UNAT, we talked about moving those communications over onto the fiber cable, and we elected to, we and the state elected to stay on the existing microwave system. Some of the federal grant money that we've gotten has gone into that partnership with the state to upgrade that system between Anchorage and Fairbanks. So there was at least some discussion with the state over the best way to haul the state's communications. I don't think it was considered in the context of an overriding overall public good that I think was dictated by the market forces. But we did look at it from the more narrow focus of how to haul the state's and the railroad's communications between Anchorage and Fairbanks.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your taking the time to come down and keep us up to date on what's happening with the railroad. And, Governor, we appreciate your continued efforts to be more user-friendly. I want to make an announcement of our Senate finance schedule for next week. On Monday morning at 9, we will convene, and we have three bills. Senator Sharp will be presiding. Senate Bill 16, Use of Fish and Game Fund; House Bill 2, Permanent Fund Eligibility; and Senate Concurrent Resolution 19, Prototype School Design. Senator Torgerson will be chairing two subcommittee meetings on Monday afternoon to hear two specific bills. At 3 o'clock, Senate Bill 179, the Matsu and Seward Prison, that's here in the Senate Finance Room. And at 3:10, I believe, or immediately after Senate Bill 179, he'll do House Bill 86, which is the PILT, known as Payment in Lieu of Taxes. That will also be happening here in the Senate Finance Room. We have Craig Holt, who is working with us and is sponsored by the State Chamber of Commerce. He's our consultant working with us on results-based government. We'll be having work sessions with him. He's going to be back in Juneau on Monday and Tuesday. He's going to be facilitating joint finance work sessions. We're going to begin writing results-based missions and measures for specific agency programs. We have invited OMB and agency managers to the table to work with us on this process. On Monday morning from 8 to 9, there is a joint House-Senate work session in the House Finance Committee room for the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. All the members of the Finance Committee, along with staff, are invited to attend that. Monday afternoon from 1:30 to 3:30, there will be the program that we'll be working with in the work session is the Alaska Marine Highway System. That should be interesting. On Tuesday morning from 9 to 11, our formal Senate Finance Committee meeting will be a program discussion of the child care programs, child care assistance, daycare assistance. Wednesday, we have bills in Senate Finance. And on Thursday morning next week, the Mental Health Trust Authority will be here at 8:30 a.m. to tell us about their successes and their challenges. They have already gone through a results-based government process. That's how they've built their budget. They're going to tell us of their successes, their challenges, and give us a feel. They've been successful. They're really excited about the their program, and I think that they want to lend us that air of excitement as we launch into results-based government. With that, is there anything else to come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned. Have a good weekend.